All right. Hello, and welcome to Sundays at the Modern. Is that good? I'm Leslie Merle. Welcome to the second to last Sundays with the Modern of the season. Next week, we'll finish up with architect Greg Manser taking us through the building. But today, it's my pleasure to introduce Carol Benson. She graduated from Texas Christian University with an MFA, has taught at TCU, UTA, and has conducted many special programs for us here at the Modern. Her work has been included in many juried and invitational exhibitions throughout the South and Southwest, including the Arkansas Art Center, LSU at Baton Rouge, the Galveston Art Center, University of Houston, and the Santa Fe Art Institute. In 2002 and again in 2003, she received first place at Art in the Metroplex at TCU. And in 2003, she was awarded an artist in residency at the Santa Fe Art Institute. In 2005, she was the featured artist in Preservation is the Art of the City, and her most recent exhibition was in December at William Campbell Contemporary Art Gallery. You have several upcoming opportunities to see her work. She has an exhibition at the Tyler Art Museum beginning this July. Her work will be included in the show Self at the new gallery, Brand 10 Art Space, this fall. And in 2012, she'll exhibit in the Cell Series at the Old Jail Museum in Albany, Texas. Please join me in welcoming Carol Benson.
All right, am I ready to go? This is working.
Okay, good.
I'll just use this as my table. This morning when I just opened the comics, it said, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Leslie, for inviting me. The Peanuts was Linus was drawing Lucy, a family portrait, and he didn't put the mouth in. And so she said, you know, where's the mouth? And so he said, I'll put that in later. And then she kept pestering him, so he finally put it in. He put in a big mouth. And so she pals him. And he says, it's hard to draw when your hand's shaking. That's going to be my theme, is that the way your hand moves in art. And some artists really capitalize on that. And so I was going to start with the Twombly sculpture here. And I thought I would pass around some of Twombly's work just to kind of refresh your memory about the kind of lines that he draws. And then we'll look at talk about his work and then look at the sculpture. This is one of his graphite drawings. It looks like graphite. Well, no, it's paint, but it looks like on a chalkboard in Houston at that at the Twombly Gallery in the Menil Collection. So that's one. These are some more pictures of his from his sculpture. So besides this one, this sort of gives you an idea of what his sculpture looks like besides the one we have here. This is a copy of another fairly recent painting, like in the last 2 or 3 years. And then I had those too, so I thought, just kind of look at these and so you'll remember. I'm supposed to hold this thing, so this is kind of hard. Let me see if I can do this, though. Wanted to talk about, I think I can do this. I wanted to talk about Twombly, and he was born in 1928 and in Virginia. He was a voracious reader, even checking out books when he was from Washington Lee University when he was a young child. He ordered paint from a Sears and Roebuck catalog. He studied with a man that was from Spain that had actually studied with Picasso's father. So early on, Twombly had this art background. And then he went to Boston, and then he came to New York, and he met Robert Rauschenberg. And Robert Rauschenberg suggested that he go to Black Mountain College. So that's where he studied with let's see, particularly Ben Shawn and Gottlieb, and I'm thinking who else, Franz Klein, because I think about those marks with him too. Another really influential thing with Twombly was that he went to Rome when he was in his early 30s, and that influenced him in the things that he wrote about and the way he titled his paintings, his subject matter. He used mythology, and that sort of influenced his thoughts too. If you were students, I would have you do something like this. And do it several times. But if you think about his marks, you know, we're using the wrist, and so you just start making just kind of abstract marks. I'm not sure I can do this, but anyway, just like this, just something. And then maybe reverse it. And then maybe I would say get real intense, something like that. But his marks, when you look at them, and when you look at these big paintings of his, he'll have little things like this. And then maybe a little bit less, it'll be real intense, and then less, and then maybe, and then I would add color, but I'm not going to add color because I don't have all that. And then some of those have something like this. Well, if you were getting into his work, you might do a whole, you know, notebook of work like this, like Franz Klein did the phone book, you know, over and over and over. So you come up with these, ideas for your paintings like that. Let's look at this sculpture. Let's move just a little bit closer and look at the sculpture. This is another thing. I don't know if most of you have seen his work in Houston. It's a big gallery. It's the Manil, you know, that whole complex. But the Twombly Gallery is across the street, and it's over 9,000 square feet. It's almost a retrospective of his whole life. So if you go there, you can really see what his work is like and has been. What I think is interesting is that, you know, it was designed by Renzo Piano, and you don't go just straight into the building. You go around to the side and then you go in. And I think entering Twombly's work that's the real clue, because it's not easy. I mean, that's why I particularly like it, is it's really challenging to see how it really does work. When you go in, that piece that I showed you about it looks like a chalkboard, you know, when you're making those lines like a cursive writing, they're huge pieces, and it's very lyrical. It's a continuous line. He would either have to be on scaffolding, you would think, you know, to make it, because they're up high, going like this, just like you were covering this whole wall. But I read that he had a friend that he just wrote on his shoulders and made those marks. So that would be cheaper, I guess. But anyway. There was another thing. We were down there one time visiting, and I had made these steel wool roses. I don't know if any of y'all remember that when I was doing that out of the... And I had used that, the poem, it's Rilke's epitaph, and it's, "Oh Rose, what a contradiction," you know, like that. And so there are lots of verses with it. But he has five paintings that he's used that poetry in. And he uses the poetry some in his work. But I mean, the fact that, you know, okay, well, I've used that, he's using that. There was just something about that connection that was interesting. Some writers talk about that his sculpture is that opposite like his work. His work can be really tight in some places and really loose and real childlike, and then actually it's harmonious. This particular piece is made from the sticks that are bound with wire and a little bit of clay put in there, and then like the plastic flowers added to it. Usually his sculptures are have a patina, just a white patina, so it unifies it. This one he didn't put the white patina in, so it's really interesting that it's just this natural material. One writer wrote about that his sculpture has the opposites that his paintings have. He has the solid material, and then he uses like plaster or some liquid. I mean, plaster is liquid when you start to work with it. For 20 minutes, it's liquid, right, Chris? but anyway, so that is your opposite. He's using these two opposite materials. I particularly like this one. Most of the work doesn't have the flower in it. But the flower, I think the flower sort of represents that really quick moment that you see that you know is not going to last very long. We were walking Friday at the river, and a guy was photographing a butterfly, you know, with his phone. And, I mean, it's that moment that you just kind of capture. And that's what I feel like a lot of times in the garden or something, you know, you get that moment that you know you're going to see only right now. And that's really important for me. I mean, the flower, I know it's you know, bronze and it's been a plastic flower, but it still has that kind of representation. My last thing here, I wanted to show you what we did in art camp. Leslie, you want to help? Well, we started, we brought in sticks and things like that, and then just bound them, and then mixed the plaster, which is a real interesting process, a bowl of water, and then just add the plaster to it until it's absorbed, and do not stir it yourself, you know. And then after it's made this perfect paste, then you have 20 minutes or so to use it. But anyway, like that. And I like the way this is so unexpected that this little bud is just, you know, I mean, that's not natural. And that's kind of the way I think he thinks. But I don't know. I like these a lot. I just thought those were, you know, little sticks. That one. We had a really nice one that was pine straw, but the girl took it home. But anyway. But this one somebody didn't take. I thought this was great because I like the blue. As you know, I've used blue lately. And we did natural material and then man-made material too. So this is this plastic, the blue plastic. Okay, I'm going to end with this because this is about blue. And since I'm using blue, I also used blue a long time ago in appropriating Matisse cutouts. This was in a Louise Bourgeois invitation lately that's currently showing in New York. Blue represents peace and meditation and escape. And so that was really, for me, just interesting. I'm just saying you connect with things different ways. You come to this in whatever your background is. And so I think about ways, you know, that I connect, and you have to do the same thing too. I would like to talk about three pieces upstairs, three paintings, three painters that use their wrist in a similar way. So let's, if you will, join me at the Susan Rothenberg piece. It's in the third gallery upstairs. Okay, thank you. I think with Susan Rothenberg's work, I like to really think about where she is and what she was doing. I suppose with any piece you have to get into it like that. But of course we've just had the show here of Moving in Place. I was thinking about this piece, like looking at it from a distance before we go up and really look at the way she makes her brush strokes, and then comparing it to the Richard Long here in that it's this circular motion. Some of the pieces that we had in the show were really definitely moving in this circle, but I think this one does too. This is really an important shape here. I mean, all of her things are just carefully thought out, and you have to look at them carefully. But this one, say if you enter here and then you move around like this and up to this head and over like that and then come back in, if you squint, like just like you're going to see your darkest areas are going to be like the red in this, and down here, you see how that makes that weight, so that if she moves you like that through this. The story is that these deer were running and she was walking her dogs, and she heard this sound of, you know, the hooves coming, and so she ran. She just remembered how this happened, and so this is one of her pieces that's like built on that memory, an experience. And so the deer are moving through. You might want to move up a little bit closer then to talk about how she paints. I know that most of you know her story well, but she was born in Buffalo, New York, and graduated from Cornell. She ended up in New York and worked for Nancy Graves. And the first thing she did for her was the big camel legs that she called a camel forest. So she was doing, you know, the big, tall camel legs. But there were also parts of the camels around in the studio, she said, which she's done parts of things. We see parts of bodies in this piece. Her first show was using the horse, and she said that the horse emerged. I mean, she was painting, and then now she had had some background. I mean, she had studied these cave drawings from the horses, and a horse jumping and a horse running with all 4 feet off the ground and things like that. So, and she talks about her work as being real active, so that she's in motion when she's doing it. She said when she is not, when it's not working, she has to get in motion. She either goes for a walk or she dances. She says she has a dance background, and also she did performance art before she even started this painting. And I think that all shows with this, you know, this kind of movement. Even on YouTube, after I decided I was going to do this, there is this, they call it the nervous brushstrokes, you know, of Susan Rothenberg. So she's painting like this. I think one of the things about her work, it's kind of like she does make sketches. She said before that she drew on envelopes and things, so she makes some sketches. So she would have this idea about how this painting would come about, but then she sort of lets the painting happen, so you just let it take over. And that's as good as it gets. I mean, that's what you want. It doesn't always happen, but you just keep, you know, waiting for something like that to happen. I think some people sort of misunderstand what her intention is. And since Robert Storr was just here, you know, last Saturday, I thought I'd read what he said. He's talking about drawing, but he says this is particularly true of Susan Rothenberg's work. Fundamentally, drawing is as much a matter of evocation as it is depiction. And so the idea is just to evoke this idea rather than to depict, you know, what the deer looked like or something like that. It's of identifying the primary qualities of things in the world and then transposing them without loss of quiddity. So we still know these are animals of some sort. And she has skulls, you know, I was thinking about, she lives now in Galisteo, so she's kind of in that area where George O'Keefe was. And she could draw this tighter, but she's very intentional about the way she's drawing it. I just, of course, just painting, I just like the way she tells us something and then she marks it out. And then, you know, she directs you with a line and then she cuts it off. But she gives you enough information like that. So, the head really reminds me of Philip Guston. I mean, you know, she says she was really influenced by him. But this is just like remembering that she saw this. So the dogs are running, I guess, through her, between her legs or something like that. And she's observing it and remembering the scene. I think I could talk about her a long time. I really like her work. But I'd like to move into Ed Blackburn's work in two galleries over. Before we go to Ed's work, I have to show this. I brought our three grandchildren to the Susan Rothenberg show, and they were drawing, so they have a little picture of two of them drawing on the floor. Anyway, the two older ones sort of did what you would expect. I mean, that was the cabin fever, you know, with the line down the, and then the one where the horse is in the middle, and I gave them black paper. Well, the little one, see, it had the black paper, and she just kept doing hers. She just filled it in, you know, with the Conte. And I thought, she nailed it, you know? So, anyway, it's funny how you can work your grandkids into a talk. Oh, gosh. Well, Ed Blackburn is just an interesting artist, and he lives here with his wife, and they collaborate a lot of their work. He was born in Amarillo in 1940, studied at the University of Texas in Berkeley and Brooklyn Art Museum, Art School. He did this piece in 81. You remember in around this time that people were appropriating other images, you know, the pop art. They used images that you were really familiar with. He's using an image that, if you don't know this particular movie, you know that this was this black and white movie that was done, you know, in the 40s or so. And he still does that with his work. He wants you to recognize what you're looking at. I mean, his characters now are like Dick Cheney and, you know, I mean, political figures that you think you've got it. You know, you look at it and you say, oh yeah, I remember that. I know what that was like. Or I know what that was even talking about or something. And so he presents it, something that you've seen, and you think, oh, yeah, I've got this. But then, you know, well, what else does this mean? And, of course, this was like a 1943 movie. It was Hopalong Cassidy. And the title is Hoppy Serves a Writ. So Hopalong Cassidy has left Texas, and he's caught this the bad guy, you know, and he's going to take him back to Texas so he'll be tried. The guy in the back, it seems like you kind of remember. I mean, my dad had two movie theaters during this time. And my husband and I remember when you paid 9 cents to see the movie. And that was for children, and it was 35 cents for adults. So we kind of, you know, that was that era, too. So you identify with what you've seen there. Now, what if you didn't know anything about the subject matter? This is just such an interesting painting, the way it's been done. And he is very knowledgeable about what he's doing, about the art. He starts with a dark gray background that's probably kind of like the suits in the back. And then he keeps just adding white to, you know, come up with the image. On this one, he projected the image. So, you know, in the movie, like, the image was projected. So he's still, like, referring to that. I've watched him paint. I mean, I've been in situations that I've seen him paint. And he's got his wrist, you know, is just going like this anyway. I mean, that's just the way he works. Like, Susan works with her brush that way. And I suppose Twombly that same way. After he did this series, and it said part was because this is Fort Worth and this is, you know, the West, where the West begins and things like that. He did a whole series of black and white movie stills. Then after that, he's always done commercial. I mean, whatever is in the media and rubbings and but there's something about it that's so casual. I mean, he has this way of doing it so that it's like, you know, you think, well, how intentional does he mean for this to be? But I like the way he works like that. He does, did a biblical series when he was 50. He said something he really wanted to do, so it was, looks like they're coloring book figures. And Joseph and David and Goliath and Jesus and cleansing the temple and things like that. But they've still got that loose, it's very characteristic of him. You know, they have, it has that loose feel about the way it's done. This was, and these movies were made in a time, you know, when it was like going back to the good days, or things were black and white, and it was, but then he doesn't paint that exactly like that. There's a lot of gray. And the more we think about it, there is a lot of gray. The mystery writer Richard Patterson, when one of his mysteries, said, "Truth is gray." And it kind of makes me think about, you know, now, I mean, I know this guy should have been captured and, you know, put in jail or something like that. But I'm just saying, it sort of sets up the situation of like, you know, well, what else is going on? And what about his mother and, you know, all this other stuff? I mean, and then I've just read that a lot of Alexander McCall Smith, and he is this writer, the Scottish writer, that does several different series, but one, and he's he teaches medical ethics, so, and that's going to be this balance, you know, there's, it's not like this, and he has in his characters the way they solve the problem. If it's, you know, if somebody goes to jail, then how are they going to take care of everything else? So how do you solve this? I mean, it's kind of like common sense. That you think, well, maybe we could be doing that a little bit more sometime in a situation. One of his characters in the African series is Madame Ramatswa. Doesn't have a gun. You know, she's a detective agent, but she doesn't have a gun, so she solves these problems without the gun. I mean, she solves how, you know, this balance of how things could work out, maybe, without violence. All of that sort of comes to me with Ed. And I know him, and I think he's so ethical, and if he's not ethical, I don't want to know it. So, I mean, I think he's just a great person. So, my last one is Milton Avery. So let's move around to the corner. I like this hung here. You know, usually it's not in this gallery. So, I mean, Michael has really moved things around. It sort of makes you see it a different way, too. This is the artist Milton Avery. And this was done in 1960. He died in 65, so this is one of his latest paintings. He was born in 1885, so he didn't have any money. I mean, his father was a tanner, and so he did blue-collar jobs. He, for his art, he worked at blue-collar jobs during the daytime and painted at night. And then he married. Last night I happened to be talking to Marla Price. You know, Marla Price did her doctoral thesis on Milton Avery. So, you know, she is very knowledgeable, of course, about and tells you these little things. And she said he was hard to do work, to write about, because there wasn't anything scandalous about him. And she said the only thing was, when he married, he was 40, and he met his wife, and she was 18. She was also an artist, but he didn't tell her his age. So he told her that he was 32. So, and she didn't know until they did a retrospective of his work that she really didn't know what his age was. Anyway, so that was the only kind of scandal about him, I guess. I remember a long time ago Marla talking about him, that he was so economical, which I think he's economical on his imagery too, but that he just wrapped the canvas just to the edge, like you just wrap it over to the side and stapled it. You know, you didn't wrap it to the back and staple it. And that was one of the ways that they could identify his work later. He continued to do that. That it was just, you know, it was just characteristic of him, I mean, to be saving like that. He studied in New York. He was born in, not in New York City, but anyway, he studied in New York, and after he married this young wife, well, he was able to paint all the time. And he painted just, I mean, amazing amount of work. Marla was saying, like, I'm going to say 2,000 are all paintings, but I mean lots of paper. He did a lot of monoprints, and so there's this abundance of work available. What is, of course, really characteristic of his work is that it's very flat, and he's not trying to show you any kind of depth at all. This particular painting, I guess I was thinking it was probably the sand in the back since it's a sand color. It's supposed to represent the ocean. So the platform is kind of the ocean color. And then this other, the water is this, what the platform might be. So it's, in his other work, that's why you can just identify it a lot of times. It comes, the background just comes right back up to you. You know, it's just, it's a flat surface. He's been compared to Matisse, but Marla said that when you put a Matisse next to his, it's totally different in the fact that the figures, these figures are flat. Matisse tries to carry you all the way around the shoulder or something. So, I mean, his figures are more, you know, natural, and that's not what Avery's attempting to do at all. So this is his wife and art dealer in Provincetown, Massachusetts. He would go there in the summer and make sketches and then go back to New York and paint. But I think he finally got a gallery there and a studio so that he could paint there too. But in seeing his work, I'm always fascinated by it. I mean, if it's in a catalog or something, it's like who, you know, you just pick out. I mean, I've got other artists too that I do that I can identify. It not looking at the work, I already like it. And so that's the way I feel about Milton Avery. I have a few images of his, too, that I might pass around. This one. He just simplifies, and I just really think that's a skill. My last image is found this one of the chicken. It's called Rooster's Domain. And this is, then last weekend we were in Luckenbach and we took a picture of the rooster down there and it has a real similar tail, so I thought I would just pass that around. So I thank you for coming. If you have questions, I'll be glad to answer that. But I hope you can see how artists do use the physical body, the physical wrist, and making and get their certain characteristics that are just unique to them, and it's all really helps identify who they are. But thank you for coming.